conduct, petty theft, and pickpocketing, with pickpockets most favoring the fair's always crowded aquarium. The guard identified 135 ex-convicts and removed them from the grounds. It issued 30 fines for carrying Kodaks without a permit, 37 for taking unauthorized photographs. It investigated the discovery on the grounds of 3 fetuses, a Pinkerton detective assaulting visitors at the Tiffany Pavilion, and a Zulu acting improperly. In his official report to Burnham, Colonel Rice, commander of the guard, wrote, "With the tens of thousands of employees and the millions of visitors, it must be admitted that our success was phenomenal." With so many people packed among steam engines, giant rotating wheels, horse-drawn fire trucks, and rocketing bobsleds, the fair's ambulances, superintended by a doctor named Gentles, were constantly delivering bruised, bloody, and overheated visitors to the exposition hospital. Over the life of the fair, the hospital treated 11,602 patients, 64 a day, for injuries and ailments that suggest the mundane sufferings of people have not changed very much over the ages. The lists included 820 cases of diarrhea, 154 constipation, 21 hemorrhoids, 434 indigestion, 365 foreign bodies in the eyes, 364 severe headaches, 594 episodes of fainting, syncope, and exhaustion, 1 case of extreme flatulence, and 169 involving teeth that hurt like hell. One of the delights of the fair was never knowing who might turn up beside you at the chocolate Venus de Milo, or at the hearse exhibit, or under the barrel of Krupp's Monster, or who might sit at the table next to yours at the Big Tree Restaurant, or the Philadelphia Cafe, or the Great White Horse Inn, a reproduction of the public house described by Dickens in the Pickwick Papers. Or who might suddenly clutch your arm aboard the Ferris wheel as your car began its ascent. Archduke Ferdinand, described by an escort as being half-boor, half-tightwad, roamed the grounds incognito, but much preferred the vice districts of Chicago. Indians who had once used hatchets to bear the skulls of white men drifted over from Buffalo Bill's compound, as did Annie Oakley and assorted Cossacks, Hussars, Lancers, and members of the U.S. 6th Cavalry, on temporary furlough, to become actors in Colonel Cody's show. Chief Standing Bear rode the Ferris wheel in full ceremonial headdress, his 200 feathers unruffled. Other Indians rode the enameled wooden horses of the Midway Carousel. There was Paderewski, Houdini, Tesla, Edison, Joplin, Darrow, a Princeton professor named Woodrow Wilson, and a sweet old lady in black summer silk, flowered with forget-me-not blue, named Susan B. Anthony. Burnham met Teddy Roosevelt for lunch. For years after the fair, Burnham used the exclamation, "Bully!" Diamond Jim Brady dined with Lillian Russell and indulged his passion for sweet corn. No one saw Twain. He came to Chicago to see the fair, but got sick and spent 11 days in his hotel room, then left without ever seeing the White City. Of all people. Chance encounters led to magic. Frank Haven Hall, superintendent of the Illinois Institution for the Education of the Blind, unveiled a new device that made plates for printing books in Braille. Previously, Hall had invented a machine capable of typing in Braille, the Hall Braille Writer, which he never patented because he felt profit should not sully the cause of serving the blind. As he stood by his newest machine, a blind girl and her escort approached him. Upon learning that Hall was the man who had invented the typewriter she used so often, the girl put her arms around his neck and gave him a huge hug and kiss. Forever afterward, whenever Hall told this story of how he met Helen Keller, tears would fill his eyes. One day, as the board of lady managers debated whether to support or oppose opening the fair on Sunday, an angry male Sabbatarian confronted Susan B. Anthony in the hall of the woman's building to challenge her contention that the fair should remain open. Anthony was not a lady manager and therefore, despite her national stature, could not participate in the board's meeting. Deploying the most shocking analogy he could muster, the clergyman asked Anthony if she'd prefer having a son of hers attend Buffalo Bill's show on Sunday instead of a church. Yes, she replied. He would learn far more. To the pious, this exchange confirmed the fundamental wickedness of Anthony's suffragist movement. When Cody learned of it, he was tickled, so much so he immediately sent Anthony a thank you note and invited her to attend his show. He offered her a box at any performance she chose. At the start of the performance, Cody entered the ring on horseback, his long gray hair streaming from under his white hat, the silver trim of his white jacket glinting in the sun. He kicked his horse into a gallop and raced toward Anthony's box. The audience went quiet. He halted his horse in a burst of dirt and dust, removed his hat, and with a great sweeping gesture, bowed until his head nearly touched the horn of his saddle. Anthony stood and returned the bow and, as enthusiastic as a girl, a friend said, waved her handkerchief at Cody. The significance of the moment escaped no one. Here was one of the greatest heroes of America's past, saluting one of the foremost heroes of its future. The encounter brought the audience to its feet in a thunder of applause and cheers. The frontier may indeed have closed at last, as Frederick Jackson Turner proclaimed in his history-making speech at the fair, but for that moment it stood there, glittering in the sun, like the track of a spent tear. There was tragedy. The British draped their elaborate ship model of the HMS Victoria in black bunting. On June 22, 1893, during maneuvers off Tripoli, this marvel of naval technology had been struck by the HMS Camperdown. The Victoria's commander ordered the ship to proceed full speed toward shore, intending to ground her there in accord with standing fleet orders meant to make it easier to raise a sunken ship. 10 minutes later, her engines still at full steam, the cruiser heeled and sank with many of her crew still trapped below deck. Others lucky enough to have jumped free now found themselves mauled by her whirling propellers or burned to death when her boilers exploded. Screams and shrieks arose, and in the white foam appeared reddened arms and legs and wrenched and torn bodies, a reporter said. Headless trunks were tossed out of the vortex to linger a moment on the surface and sink out of sight. The accident cost 400 lives. The Ferris wheel quickly became the most popular attraction of the exposition. Thousands rode it every day. The Ferris wheel quickly became the most popular attraction of the exposition. Thousands rode it every day. In the week beginning July 3rd, Ferris sold 61,395 tickets for a gross return of $30,697.50. The exposition company took about half, leaving Ferris an operating profit for that one week of $13,948, equivalent today to about $400,000. There were still questions about the wheel's safety, and unfounded stories circulated about suicides and accidents, including one that alleged that a frightened pug had leapt to its death from one of the car's windows. Not true, the Ferris Company said. The story was the concoction of a reporter, short on news and long on invention. If not for the wheel's windows and iron grates, however, its record might have been different. On one ride, a latent terror of heights suddenly overwhelmed an otherwise peaceful man named Werrett. He was fine until the car began to move. As it rose, he began to feel ill and nearly fainted. There was no way to signal the engineer below to stop the wheel. Werrett staggered in panic from one end of the car to the other, driving passengers before him like scared sheep, according to one account. He began throwing himself at the walls of the car with such power that he managed to bend some of the protective iron. The conductor and several male passengers tried to subdue him, but he shook them off and raced for the door. In accord with the wheel's operating procedures, the conductor had locked the door at the start of the ride. Werrett shook it and broke its glass, but could not get it open. As the car entered its descent, Werrett became calmer and laughed and sobbed with relief, until he realized the wheel was not going to stop. It always made two full revolutions. Werrett again went wild, and again the conductor and his allies subdued him, but they were growing tired. They feared what might happen if Werrett escaped them. Structurally, the car was sound, but its walls, windows, and doors had been designed merely to discourage attempts at self-destruction, not to resist a human pile driver. Already, Werrett had broken glass and bent iron. A woman stepped up and unfastened her skirt. To the astonishment of all aboard, she slipped the skirt off and threw it over Werrett's head, then held it in place while murmuring gentle assurances. The effect was immediate. Werrett became as quiet as an ostrich. A woman disrobing in public. A man with a skirt over his head. The marvels of the fair seemed endless. The exposition was Chicago's great pride. Thanks mainly to Daniel Burnham, the city had proved it could accomplish something marvelous against obstacles that by any measure should have humbled the builders. The sense of ownership was everywhere, and not just among the tens of thousands of citizens who had bought exposition stock. Hilda Satt noticed it in the change that came over her father as he showed her the grounds. He seemed to take a personal pride in the fair, as if he had helped in the planning, she said. As I look back on those days, most people in Chicago felt that way. Chicago was host to the world at that time, and we were part of it all. But the fair did more than simply stoke pride. It gave Chicago a light to hold against the gathering dark of economic calamity. The Erie Railroad wobbled, then collapsed. Next went the Northern Pacific. In Denver, three national banks failed in one day and pulled down an array of other businesses. Fearing a bread riot, city authorities called out the militia. In Chicago, the editors of the Inland Architect tried to be reassuring. Existing conditions are only an accident. Capital is only hidden. Enterprise is only frightened, not beaten. The editors were wrong. In June, two businessmen committed suicide on the same day in the same Chicago hotel, the Metropole. One slit his throat with a razor at 10:30 in the morning. The other learned of the suicide from the hotel barber. That night in his own room, he tied one end of the silk sash of his smoking jacket around his neck, then stretched out on the bed and tied the other end to the bedstead. He rolled off. "Everyone is in a blue fit of terror," wrote Henry Adams, "and each individual thinks himself more ruined than his neighbor." Long before the fair's end, people began mourning its inevitable passage. Mary Hartwell Catherwood wrote, "What shall we do when this wonderland is closed? When it disappears? When the enchantment comes to an end?" One lady manager, Sally Cotton of North Carolina, a mother of six children staying in Chicago for the summer, captured in her diary a common worry, that after seeing the fair, everything will seem small and insignificant. The fair was so perfect, its grace and beauty like an assurance, that for as long as it lasted, nothing truly bad could happen to anyone, anywhere. Independence Day. The morning of July 4th, 1893, broke gray and squally. The weather threatened to dull the elaborate fireworks display that Frank Millet had planned as a further boost for the exposition's attendance, which despite steady week-to-week increases, still lagged expectation. The sun emerged late in the morning, though squalls continued to sweep Jackson Park through much of the day. By late afternoon, a soft gold light bathed the Court of Honor, and storm clouds walled the northern sky. The storms came no closer. The crowds built quickly. Holmes, Minnie, and Nanny found themselves locked within an immense throng of humid men and women. Many people carried blankets and hampers of food, but quickly found that no room remained to spread a picnic. There were few children. The entire Colombian Guard seemed to be present, their pale blue uniforms standing out like crocuses against black loam. Gradually, the gold light cooled to lavender. Everyone began walking toward the lake. For half a mile along the splendid sweep of the lakefront, men were massed, 100 deep, the Tribune reported. This black sea of people was restless. For hours they sat and waited, filling the air with a strange, uneasy uproar. One man began singing, "Nearer, my God, to thee," and immediately a few thousand people joined in. As darkness fell, everyone watched the sky for the first rockets of the night's display. Thousands of Chinese lanterns hung from trees and railings. Red lights glowed from each car of the Ferris wheel. On the lake, 100 or more ships, yachts, and launches lay at anchor with colored lights on their bows and booms and strung along their rigging. The crowd was ready to cheer for anything. It cheered when the Exposition Orchestra played Home Sweet Home, a song that never failed to reduce grown men and women to tears, especially the newest arrivals to the city. It cheered when the lights came on within the Court of Honor and all the palaces became outlined in gold. It cheered when the big searchlights atop the manufacturer's building began sweeping the crowd, and when colorful plumes of water, peacock feathers, the Tribune called them, began erupting from the McMonnies fountain. At 9 o'clock, however, the crowd hushed. A small, bright light had arisen in the sky to the north and appeared to be drifting along the lakeshore toward the wharf. One of the searchlights found it and revealed it to be a large manned balloon. A light flared well below its basket. In the next instant, bursts of sparks in red, white, and blue formed a huge American flag against the black sky. The balloon and flag drifted overhead. The searchlight followed, its beam clearly outlined in the sulfur cloud that trailed the balloon. Seconds later, rockets began arcing over the lakeshore. Men with flares raced along the beach, lighting mortars, as other men aboard barges set off large rotating flares and hurled bombs into the lake, causing the water to explode in extravagant geysers of red, white, and blue. Bombs and rockets followed in intensifying numbers until the climax of the show, when an elaborate wire network erected at Festival Hall on the lakeshore abruptly flared into a giant, explosive portrait of George Washington. The crowd cheered. Everyone began moving at the same time, and soon a great black glacier was moving toward the exits and the stations of the Alley L and Illinois Central. Holmes and the Williams sisters waited hours for their turn to board one of the northbound trains, but the wait did nothing to dampen their spirits. That night, the Oker family heard joking and laughter coming from the upstairs flat at 1220 Wrightwood. There was good reason for the merriment within. Holmes had further sweetened the night with an astonishingly generous offer to Minnie and Nanny. Before bed, Nanny wrote home to her aunt in Texas to tell her the excellent news. "Sister, Brother Harry and myself will go to Milwaukee tomorrow, and we'll go to Old Orchard Beach, Maine, by way of the St. Lawrence River. We'll visit 2 weeks in Maine, then on to New York. Brother Harry thinks I am talented. He wants me to look around about studying art. Then we will sail for Germany by way of London and Paris. If I like it, I will stay and study art. Brother Harry says you need never trouble any more about me, financially or otherwise. He and sister will see to me." Write me right away, she added, and address to Chicago, and the letter will be forwarded to me. She said nothing about her trunk, which was still in Midlothian awaiting shipment to Chicago. She would have to get along without it for now. Once it arrived, she could arrange by telegraph to have it forwarded as well, perhaps to Maine or New York, so that she could have all her things in hand for the voyage to Europe. Nanny went to bed that night with her heart still racing from the excitement of the fair and Holmes's surprise. Later, William Capp, an attorney with the Texas firm of Capp and Canty, said Nanny had no property of her own, and such a change as described in her letter meant everything for her. The next morning promised to be pleasant as well, for Holmes had announced he would take Nanny, just her, to Englewood for a brief tour of his World's Fair Hotel. He had to attend to a few last-minute business matters before the departure for Milwaukee. In the meantime, Minnie would ready the Wrightwood flat for whatever tenant happened to rent it next. Holmes was such a charming man. And now that Nanny knew him, she saw that he really was quite handsome. When his marvelous blue eyes caught hers, they seemed to warm her entire body. Minnie had done well indeed. Worry. At the fairgrounds later that night, the ticket men counted their sales and found that for that single day, July 4th, paid attendance had totaled 283,273, far greater than the entire first week of the fair. It was the first clear evidence that Chicago might have created something extraordinary after all, and renewed Burnham's hopes that the fair at last would achieve the level of attendance he had hoped for. But the next day, only 79,034 paying visitors came to see the fair. 3 days later, the number sagged to 44,537. The bankers carrying the fair's debt grew anxious. The fair's auditor already had discovered that Burnham's department had spent over $22 million to build the fair, roughly $725 million in 21st century dollars, more than twice the amount originally planned. The bankers were pressuring the exposition's directors to appoint a retrenchment committee, empowered not just to seek out ways of reducing the fair's expenses, but to execute whatever cost-saving measures it deemed necessary, including layoffs and the elimination of departments and committees. Burnham knew that placing the future of the fair in the hands of bankers would mean its certain failure. The only way to ease the pressure was to boost the total of paid admissions to far higher levels. Estimates held that to avoid financial failure, a humiliation for Chicago's prideful leading men who counted themselves lords of the dollar, the fair would have to sell a minimum of 100,000 tickets a day for the rest of its run. To even have a hope of achieving this, the railroads would have to reduce their fares, and Frank Millet would have to intensify his efforts to attract people from all corners of the country. With the nation's economic depression growing ever more profound, banks failing, suicides multiplying, it seemed an impossibility. And then, things got worse. Claustrophobia. Holmes knew that most, if not all, of his hotel guests would be at the fair. He showed Nanny the drugstore, restaurant, and barber shop, and took her up to the roof to give her a broader view of Englewood and the pretty, tree-shaded neighborhood that surrounded his corner. He ended the tour at his office, where he offered Nanny a seat and excused himself. He picked up a sheaf of papers and began reading. Distractedly, he asked Nanny if she would mind going into the adjacent room, the walk-in vault, to retrieve for him a document he had left inside. Cheerfully, she complied. Holmes followed quietly. At first, it seemed as though the door had closed by accident. The room was utterly without light. Nanny pounded on the door and called for Harry. She listened, then pounded again. She was not frightened, just embarrassed. She did not like the darkness, which was more complete than anything she had ever experienced, far darker, certainly, than any moonless night in Texas. She rapped the door with her knuckles and listened again. The air grew stale. Holmes listened. He sat peacefully in a chair by the wall that separated his office and the vault. Time passed. It was really very peaceful. A soft breeze drifted through the room, cross-ventilation being one of the benefits of a corner office. The breeze, still cool, carried the morning scent of prairie grasses and moist soil. Nanny removed her shoe and beat the heel against the door. The room was growing warmer. Sweat filmed her face and arms. She guessed that Harry, unaware of her plight, had gone elsewhere in the building. That would explain why he still had not come, despite her pounding. Perhaps he had gone to check on something in the shops below. As she considered this, she became a bit frightened. The room had grown substantially warmer. Catching a clean breath was difficult, and she needed a bathroom. He would be so apologetic. She could not show him how afraid she was. She tried shifting her thoughts to the journey they would begin that afternoon. That she, a Texas schoolmarm, soon would be walking the streets of London and Paris still seemed an impossibility, yet Harry had promised it and made all the arrangements. In just a few hours, she would board a train for the short trip to Milwaukee, and soon afterwards she, Minnie, and Harry would be on their way to the lovely, cool valley of the St. Lawrence River between New York and Canada. She saw herself sitting on the spacious porch of some fine riverside hotel, sipping tea and watching the sun descend. She hammered the door again, and now also the wall between the vault and Harry's breeze-filled office. The panic came, as it always did. Holmes imagined Nanny crumpled in a corner. If he chose, he could rush to the door and throw it open, and hold her in his arms and weep with her at the tragedy just barely averted. He could do it at the last minute, in the last few seconds. He could do that. Or he could open the door and look in on Nanny, and give her a big smile, just to let her know that this was no accident, then close the door again, slam it, and return to his chair to see what might happen next. Or he could flood the vault, right now, with gas. The hiss and repulsive odor would tell her just as clearly as a smile that something extraordinary was underway. He could do any of these things. He had to concentrate to hear the sobs from within. The airtight fittings, the iron walls, and the mineral wool insulation deadened most of the sound, but he had found with experience that if he listened at the gas pipe, he heard everything much more clearly. This was the time he most craved. It brought him a period of sexual release that seemed to last for hours, even though, in fact, the screams and pleading faded rather quickly. He filled the vault with gas, just to be sure. Holmes returned to the Wrightwood apartment and told Minnie to get ready. Nanny was waiting for them at the castle. He held Minnie and kissed her, and told her how lucky he was and how much he liked her sister. During the train ride to Englewood, he seemed well-rested and at peace, as if he had just ridden his bicycle for miles and miles. 2 days later, on July 7th, the Ocker family received a letter from Henry Gordon stating that he no longer needed the apartment. The letter came as a surprise. The Okers believed Gordon and the two sisters still occupied the flat. Laura Oker went upstairs to check. She knocked, heard nothing, then entered. "I do not know how they got out of the house," she said, "but there were evidences of hasty packing, a few books and odds and ends being left lying about. If there had been any writing in the books, all traces were removed, for the fly leaves had been torn out." Also on July 7th, the Wells Fargo agent in Midlothian, Texas, loaded a large trunk into the baggage car of a northbound train. The trunk was addressed to a Miss Nanny Williams, care of H. Gordon, 1220 Wrightwood Avenue, Chicago. The trunk reached the city several days later. A Wells Fargo drayman tried to deliver it to the Wrightwood address but could not locate anyone named Williams or Gordon. He returned the trunk to the Wells Fargo office. No one came to claim it. Holmes called upon an Englewood resident named Cephas Humphrey, who owned his own team and dray and made a living transporting furniture, crates, and other large objects from place to place. Holmes asked him to pick up a box and a trunk. "I want you to come after the stuff about dark," Holmes said, "as I do not care to have the neighbors see it go away." Humphrey showed up as requested. Holmes led him into the castle and upstairs to a windowless room with a heavy door. "It was an awful-looking place," Humphrey said. "There were no windows in it at all, and only a heavy door opening into it. It made my flesh creep to go in there. I felt as if something was wrong, but Mr. Holmes did not give me much time to think about that." The box was a long rectangle made of wood, roughly the dimensions of a coffin. Humphrey carried it down first. Out on the sidewalk, he stood it on end. Holmes, watching from above, rapped hard on the window and called down, "Don't do that. Lay it down flat." Humphreys did so, then walked back upstairs to retrieve the trunk. It was heavy, but its weight gave him no trouble. Holmes instructed him to take the long box to the Union Depot and told him where on the platform to place it. Apparently, Holmes had made prior arrangements with an express agent to pick up the box and load it on a train. He did not disclose its destination. As for the trunk, Humphrey could not recall where he took it, but later evidence suggests he took it to the home of Charles Chapel, near Cook County Hospital. Soon afterward, Holmes brought an unexpected but welcome gift to the family of his assistant, Benjamin Pitetzel. He gave Pitetzel's wife, Carrie, a collection of dresses, several pairs of shoes, and some hats that had belonged to his cousin, a Miss Minnie Williams, who had gotten married and moved east and no longer needed her old things. He recommended that Carrie cut up the dresses and use the material to make clothing for her three daughters. Carrie was very grateful. Holmes also surprised his caretaker, Pat Quinlan, with a gift. Two sturdy trunks, each bearing the initials M.R.W. Storm and fire. Burnham's work did not cease. The pace at his office did not slow. The fair buildings were complete and all exhibits were in place, but just as surely as silver tarnishes, the fair became subject to the inevitable forces of degradation and decline, and tragedy. On Sunday, July 9th, a day of heat and stillness, the Ferris wheel became one of the most sought-after places to be, as did the basket of the Midway's captive balloon. The balloon, named Chicago, was filled with 100,000 cubic feet of hydrogen and controlled by a tether connected to a winch. By 3 o'clock that afternoon, it had made 35 trips aloft to an altitude of 1,000 feet. As far as the concession's German aerialist was concerned, the day had been a perfect one for ascensions, so still, he estimated, that a plumb line dropped from the basket would have touched the winch directly below. At 3 o'clock, however, the manager of the concession, G.F. Morgan, checked his instruments and noted a sudden decline in barometric pressure, evidence that a storm was forming. He halted the sale of new tickets and ordered his men to reel in the balloon. The operators of the Ferris wheel, he saw, did not take equivalent precautions. The wheel continued to turn. Clouds gathered, the sky purpled, and a breeze rose from the northwest. The sky sagged toward the ground, and a small funnel cloud appeared, which began wobbling south along the lakeshore toward the fair. The Ferris wheel was full of passengers, who watched with mounting concern as the funnel did its own danse de ventre across Jackson Park directly toward the midway. At the base of the captive balloon, Manager Morgan ordered his men to grab mooring ropes and hang on tight. Within Jackson Park, the sudden shift from sunlight to darkness drew Burnham outside. A powerful wind reared from all directions. Lunch wraps took flight and wheeled in the air like gulls. The sky seemed to reach into the exposition, and somewhere glass shattered. Not the gentle tinkling of a window extinguished by a stone, but the hurt dog yelp of large sheets falling to the ground. In the agriculture building, a giant pane of glass fell from the roof and shattered the table at which, just a few seconds earlier, a young woman had been selling candy. 6 roof panes blew from the manufacturer's building. Exhibitors raced to cover their displays with duck cloth. The wind tore a 40-square-foot segment from the dome of Machinery Hall and lifted the roof off the fair's Hungarian Cafe. The crew of one of Olmsted's electric launches made a hasty landing to evacuate all passengers and had just begun motoring toward shelter when a burst of wind caught the boat's awning and whipped the 5-ton craft onto its side. The pilot and conductor swam to safety. Giant feathers rocked in the air. The 28 ostriches of the Midway Ostrich Farm bore the loss with their usual aplomb. In the wheel, riders braced themselves. One woman fainted. A passenger later wrote to Engineering News, "It took the combined effort of 2 of us to close the doors tight. The wind blew so hard the raindrops appeared to be flowing almost horizontal instead of vertical." The wheel continued to turn, however, as if no wind were blowing. Passengers felt only a slight vibration. The letter writer, apparently an engineer, estimated the wind deflected the wheel to one side by only 1.5 inches. The riders watched as the wind gripped the adjacent captive balloon and tore it from the men holding it down and briefly yanked Manager Morgan into the sky. The wind pummeled the balloon as if it were an inverted punching bag, then tore it to pieces and cast shreds of its 9,000 yards of silk as far as 1/2 mile away. Morgan took the disaster calmly. "I got some pleasure out of watching the storm come up," he said, "and it was a sight of a lifetime to see the balloon go to pieces, even if it was a costly bit of sightseeing for the people who own stock in the company." Whether the storm had anything to do with the events of the next day, Monday, July 10th, can't be known, but the timing was suspicious. On Monday, shortly after 1 o'clock, as Burnham supervised repairs and crews removed storm debris from the grounds, smoke began to rise from the cupola of the cold storage tower, where the fire of June 17th also had taken light. The tower was made of wood and housed a large iron smokestack, which vented 3 boilers located in the main building below. Paradoxically, heat was required to produce cold. The stack rose to a point 30 inches short of the top of the tower, where an additional iron assembly called a thimble was to have been placed to extend the stack so that it cleared the top completely. The thimble was a crucial part of architect Frank Burnham's design, meant to shield the surrounding wooden walls from the superheated gases exiting the stack. For some reason, however, the contractor had not installed it. The building was like a house whose chimney ended not above the roof, but inside the attic. The first alarm reached the fire department at 1:32 p.m. Engines thundered to the building. 20 firemen, led by Captain James Fitzpatrick, entered the main structure and climbed to its roof. From there, they made their way to the tower and climbed stairs another 70 feet to the tower's exterior balcony. Using ropes, they hauled up a line of hose and a 25-foot ladder. They secured the hose firmly to the tower. Fitzpatrick and his men didn't realize it, but the fire at the top of the tower had set a lethal trap. Fragments of burning debris had fallen into the space between the iron stack and the inner walls of the tower, made of smooth, white pine. These flaming brands ignited a fire which, in those narrow confines, soon depleted the available air and extinguished its own flames, leaving in their place a superheated plasma that needed only a fresh supply of oxygen to become explosive. As the firemen on the tower balcony concentrated on the fire above them, a small plume of white smoke appeared at their feet. The fire department rang a second alarm at 1:41 p.m. and activated the big siren at the exposition's machinery hall. Thousands of visitors now moved toward the smoke and packed the lawns and paths surrounding the building. Some brought lunch. Burnham came, as did Davis. The Colombian Guard arrived in force to clear the way for additional engines and ladder wagons. Riders on the Ferris wheel got the clearest, most horrific view of what happened next. Never, the fire department reported, was so terrible a tragedy witnessed by such a sea of agonized faces. Suddenly, flames erupted from the tower at a point about 50 feet below Fitzpatrick and his men. Fresh air rushed into the tower. An explosion followed. To the firemen, according to the department's official report, it appeared as though the gaseous contents of the air shaft surrounding the smokestack had become ignited, and the entire interior of the tower at once became a seething furnace. Fireman John Davis was standing on the balcony with Captain Fitzpatrick and the other men. "I saw there was only one chance, and I made up my mind to take it," Davis said. "I made a leap for the hose and had the good luck to catch it." The rest of the boys seemed transfixed with horror and unable to move. Davis and one other man rode the hose to the ground. The firemen still on the balcony knew their situation was deadly and began to tell each other goodbye. Witnesses watched them hug and shake hands. Captain Fitzpatrick grabbed a rope and swung down through the fire to the main roof below, where he lay with a fractured leg and internal injuries. Half his huge mustache burned away. Other men jumped to their deaths, in some cases penetrating the main roof. Fire Marshal Murphy and two other firemen on the ground climbed a ladder to retrieve Fitzpatrick. They lowered him by rope to colleagues waiting below. He was alive, but fading. In all, the blaze killed 12 firemen and 3 workers. Fitzpatrick died at 9 o'clock that night. The next day, attendance exceeded 100,000. The still-smoking rubble of the cold storage building had proved irresistible. The coroner immediately convened an inquest, during which a jury heard testimony from Daniel Burnham, Frank Burnham, officials of Hercules Ironworks, and various firemen. Daniel Burnham testified he had not known of the previous fire or the omitted thimble, and claimed that since the building was a private concession, he had no authority over its construction beyond approving its design. On Tuesday, July 18th, the jury charged him, Fire Marshal Murphy, and 2 Hercules officers with criminal negligence, and referred the charges to a grand jury. Burnham was stunned, but kept his silence. "The attempt to hold you in any degree responsible or censurable for the loss of life is an outrage," wrote Dion Geraldine, his construction superintendent at the fair. "The men who gave this verdict must have been very stupid or sadly misinformed." Under customary procedures, Burnham and the others would have been placed under arrest pending bail, but in this instance, even the coroner's office seemed taken aback. The sheriff made no move to arrest the director of works. Burnham posted bond the next morning. With the stink of charred wood still heavy in the air, Burnham closed the roof walks of the transportation and manufacturers' buildings and the balconies and upper galleries of the administration building, fearing that a fire in the buildings or among their exhibits could start a panic and cause a tragedy of even greater magnitude. Hundreds of people had crowded the roof walk of the manufacturer's building each day, but their only way down was by elevator. Burnham imagined terrified men, women, and children trying to slide down the glass flanks of the roof and breaking through, then falling 200 feet to the exhibit floor. As if things could not get any blacker, on the same day that the coroner's jury ordered Burnham's arrest, July 18th, the directors of the exposition bowed to bank pressure and voted to establish a retrenchment committee with nearly unrestricted powers to cut costs throughout the fair and appointed 3 cold-eyed men to staff it. A subsequent resolution approved by the fair's board of directors stated that as of August 1st, no expenditures whatever connected with the construction, maintenance, or conduct of the exposition shall be incurred unless authorized by said committee. It was clear from the start that the committee's primary target was Burnham's Department of Works. Equally clear, at least to Burnham, was that the last thing the fair needed right now, as he and Millett continued their fight to boost the rate of paid admissions, a campaign with its own necessary costs, was to have a troika of penny pinchers sitting in judgment on every new expense. Millett had some extraordinary ideas for events in August, including an elaborate midway ball during which fair officials, including Burnham, would dance with Dahomey women and Algerian belly dancers. That the committee would view the expense of this ball and other of Millett's events as frivolous seemed certain. Yet Burnham knew that such expenditures, as well as expenditures on police, garbage removal, and maintenance of roads and lawns, was vital. He feared that the retrenchment committee would cripple the fair for once and for all. Love. The remains of the cold storage fire were still visible as a party of school teachers arrived from St. Louis, accompanied by a young reporter. The 24 teachers had won a contest held by the St. Louis Republic, which entitled them to a free stay at the fair at the newspaper's expense. Along with assorted friends and family members, for a total of 40 travelers, they had piled into a luxurious sleeper car named Benares, provided by the Chicago and Alton Railroad. They arrived at Chicago's Union Depot on Monday, July 17th, at 8 o'clock in the morning, and went immediately by carriage to their hotel, the Varsity, located close enough to the fair that from its second-floor balcony, the teachers could see the Ferris wheel, the top of the manufacturer's building, and Big Mary's gilded head. The reporter, Theodore Dreiser, was young and suffused with a garish self-confidence that drew the attention of the young women. He flirted with all, but of course was drawn most to the one woman who seemed least interested, a small, pretty, and reserved woman named Sarah Osborne White, whom a past suitor had nicknamed Jug for her tendency to wear brown. She was hardly Dreiser's type. By now he was sexually experienced and in the middle of an entirely physical affair with his landlady. To him, Sarah White exuded an intense something, concealed by an air of supreme innocence and maidenly reserve. Dreiser joined the teachers on the Ferris wheel and accompanied them on a visit to Buffalo Bill's show, where Colonel Cody himself greeted the women and shook hands with each. Dreiser followed the ladies through the manufacturer's building where, he said, a man could trail round from place to place for a year and not get tired. In the midway, Dreiser persuaded James J. Corbett to meet the woman. Corbett was the boxer who had downed John L. Sullivan in the great fight of September 1892, a battle that had consumed the entire front page of the next morning's Chicago Tribune. Corbett, too, shook the women's hands, although one teacher declined the opportunity. Her name was Sullivan. Every chance he got, Dreiser tried to separate Sarah White from the Republic's entourage, which Dreiser called the 40-odd, but Sarah had brought along her equally pretty and far more lively sister Rose, which complicated things. On at least one occasion, Dreiser tried to kiss Sarah. She told him not to be sentimental. He failed at seduction, but was himself successfully seduced by the fair. It had swept him, he said, into a dream from which I did not recover for months. Most captivating were the nights, when the long shadows have all merged into one, and the stars begin to gleam out over the lake and the domes of the palaces of the White City. Sarah White remained on his mind long after he and the 40-odd departed the fair. In St. Louis he wrote to her and courted her, and in the process resolved to make more of himself as a writer. He left St. Louis for a job editing a rural Michigan newspaper, but found the realities of being a small-town editor did not live up to the fantasy. After a few other stops, he reached Pittsburgh. He wrote to Sarah White and visited her whenever he returned to St. Louis. He asked her to sit in his lap. She refused. She did, however, accept his proposal of marriage. Dreiser showed a friend, John Maxwell of the St. Louis Globe Democrat, her photograph. Where Dreiser saw an enticing woman of mystery, Maxwell saw a schoolmarm of drab demeanor. He tried to warn Dreiser, "If you marry now, and a conventional and narrow woman at that, one older than you, you're gone." It was good advice for a man like Dreiser, but Dreiser did not take it. The Ferris wheel became a vector for love. Couples asked permission to be married at the highest point on the wheel. Luther Rice never allowed it, but in two cases where the couples already had mailed invitations, he did permit weddings in his office. Despite the wheel's inherent romantic potential, however, rides at night never became popular. The favorite hour was the golden time between 5 and 6 in the evening. Holmes, newly free and land rich, brought a new woman to the fair, Georgiana Yoke, whom he had met earlier in the year at a department store, Schlesinger and Meyer, where she worked as a saleswoman. She had grown up in Franklin, Indiana, and lived there with her parents until 1891, when she set out for a bigger, more glamorous life in Chicago. She was only 23 when she met Holmes, but her small size and sun-blonde hair made her look much younger, almost like a child, save for the sharp features of her face and the intelligence that inhabited her very large blue eyes. She had never met anyone like him. He was handsome, articulate, and clearly well off. He even possessed property in Europe. She felt a certain sadness for him, however. He was so alone. All his family was dead, save one aunt living in Africa. His last uncle had just died and left him a large fortune comprised of property in the South and in Fort Worth, Texas. Holmes gave her many presents, among them a Bible, diamond earrings, and a locket. A little heart, she said, with pearls. At the fair, he took her on the Ferris wheel and hired a gondola and walked with her on the dark, fragrant paths of the wooded island in the soft glow of Chinese lanterns. He asked her to be his wife. She agreed instantly. He cautioned, however, that for the marriage he would have to use a different name, Henry Mansfield Howard. It was his dead uncle's name, he said. The uncle was blood proud and had bequeathed Holmes his estate on condition he first adopt the uncle's name in full. Holmes had obliged out of respect for his uncle's memory. Mayor Harrison, too, believed he was in love with a New Orleans woman named Annie Howard. He was 68 and a widower twice over. She was in her 20s. No one knew exactly where in her 20s, but estimates put her between 21 and 27 years old. She was very plump, by one account, and full of life. She had come to Chicago for the duration of the fair and was renting a mansion near the mayor's. She spent her days at the fair buying art. Harrison and Miss Howard had some news for the city, but the mayor had no plans to reveal it until October 28th, when the exposition would host American Cities Day. His day, really. 2 days before the official close, but the day when he would get to stand before several thousand mayors from around the country and revel in his stature as mayor of Chicago, the city that built the greatest fair of all time. Freaks. On July 31st, 1893, after two investigative hearings, the Retrenchment Committee gave its report to the Exposition's Board of Directors. The report stated that the financial management of the fair can only be characterized as shamefully extravagant. Drastic cuts in spending and staff were necessary immediately. As to the construction department, we hardly know what to say, the report continued. We had no time to go into details, but have formed the decided impression that this is being run now, as in the past, upon the general theory that money is no object. The Retrenchment Committee made it clear that, at least for its three members, the financial success of the fair was as important as its obvious aesthetic success. The honor of Chicago's leading men, who prided themselves on their unsentimental, some might say ruthless, pursuit of maximum profit, was in peril. The report closed, "If we are not to be disgraced before the public as businessmen, this matter must be followed up sharply and decisively." In separate statements, the Retrenchment Committee urged the directors to make the committee permanent and invest it with the power to approve or deny every expenditure at the exposition, no matter how small. This was too much, even for the equally hardened businessmen of the exposition board. President Higginbotham said he would resign before he would cede such power to anyone. Other directors felt likewise. Stung by this rejection, the three men of the Retrenchment Committee themselves resigned. One told a reporter, "If the directory had seen fit to continue the committee with power as originally intended, it would have dropped heads enough to fill the Grand Court Basin." The retrencher's report had been too harsh, too much a rebuke, at a time when the mood throughout Chicago was one of sustained exultation at the fact that the fair had gotten built at all, and that it had proven more beautiful than anyone had imagined. Even New York had apologized. Well, at least one editor from New York. Charles T. Root, editor of the New York Dry Goods Reporter, and no relation to Burnham's dead partner, published an editorial on Thursday, August 10, 1893, in which he cited the ridicule and hostility that New York editors had expressed ever since Chicago won the right to build the exposition. Hundreds of newspapers, among them scores of the strongest Eastern dailies, held their sides with merriment over the exquisite humor of the idea of this crude, upstart, pork-packing city undertaking to conceive and carry out a true World's Fair. The carping had subsided, he wrote, but few of the carpers had as yet made the amende honorable that now clearly was due Chicago. He compounded his own heresy by adding that if New York had won the fair, it would not have done as fine a job. "So far as I have been able to observe, New York never gets behind any enterprise as Chicago got behind this. And without that splendid pulling together, prestige, financial supremacy, and all that sort of thing would not go far toward paralleling the White City." It was time, he said, to acknowledge the truth. Chicago has disappointed her enemies and astonished the world. None of the exposition directors or officers had any illusions, however. The rate of paid admissions, though rising steadily, had to be increased still more and soon. Only 3 months remained until the closing ceremony on October 30th. The closure was supposed to happen at the end of October, meaning October 31st, but some unidentified crafter of the federal legislation erred in thinking October only had 30 days. The directors stepped up pressure on the railroads to lower fares. The Chicago Tribune made fare reductions a crusade and openly attacked the railroads. "They are unpatriotic, for this is a national, not a local fare," an editorial charged on August 11, 1893. "They are also desperately and utterly selfish." The next